All right, welcome back to radio.com here in Boston. I'm Mike Mullaney. This is New England Lifestyles. And, you know, whenever I want to talk politics, there's a couple of people I go to. But when I want the fiery conversation, I go to my friend, New York voting rights attorney and trial attorney, Richard C. Bell. Mr. Bell, it is great to talk to you again. It is great to talk. And by the way, you have a book which has been the source of a couple of conversations. It's called Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. You still want to stick by that? Because we saw a pretty crazy act of resistance the other day, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. So first of all, thanks so much for having me back. I always enjoy our very lively conversations. And yes, I'm sticking by voting is the ultimate act of resistance, and more than ever, because one of the premises of my book about voter suppression is that you want to turn your anger into action and your ideas into laws, and that's what voting does. And I think the disgusting and ugly and seditious and criminal acts that we all witnessed at the Capitol are proof positive why voting counts. Because when you don't vote, or you vote for the wrong people, you get the kind of demagoguery and inciting that happened that led to these events. So now, I stick by what I said.
And let's be honest about this. Let's really break this down into reality of what happened. Voting took place on Election Day this year in November. More people voted in the United States this year than ever before. And as a result of the election, and a result of what has happened in the days after the election, the United States has, you know, it's funny, people said that Donald Trump was going to change the face of the Republican Party. Well, he ended up costing them the Oval Office, Congress, in the Senate, and the House of Representatives. It's one of those stunning things.
All true.
And it was done through voting. I mean, what we've seen is despite what we saw, the folks at the Capitol going in there trying to change what happened, they were not able to disrupt the voting process, because that is the fundamental part of what our country does. And voting overcame what we saw. It's a pretty stunning display.
It is a stunning display because, you know, the felonies, which are felonies, sedition and domestic terrorism and political insurrection, they didn't win. What won was the will of the people.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing stuff. And, you know, I when you look at the runoff election, which ended up tilting the balance of power in the Senate, I'm not sure that the passion for going back out for that second election is there without what happened in the days after and the repeated claims of a fraudulent election in Georgia. I think that really fired up the voting bloc. I mean, it's really one of, again, you know, you never thought you would see it, but what we've seen play out over these past, you know, 2 or 3 months has been an amazing lesson in civics, hasn't it been?
Oh, it has, Mike, and I couldn't agree with you more. And one of the premises of my book, Voting the Ultimate Act of Resistance, is I give my history fighting voter suppression the last 20 years, both in the courtroom and at the polling places. And I don't think that anything got voters to come out more than all the acts of suppression, whether it was these frivolous cases brought by the Trump administration the months leading up to it, or acts of trying to purge voter rolls, or what happened when we saw those lines in the primaries in Wisconsin and Georgia. The voter suppression this time completely backfired on them.
It really did.
And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, and look, when it comes down to it, that's the thing. You've seen, what are the things you've seen malaise over the years of people not taking part? Unless, and you know, you see elections where only 30% of registered voters take part, you know, and that's on some lucky days. I mean, there's some state elections which have even less than that, but you really saw something where, you know, in excess of 75% of people came out, and that, while it doesn't sound great on the surface, it's a pretty stunning display. And it's really something special to see what we saw. Now, one of the things that we talked about was, you know, how someone could challenge an election. And we kind of saw that. We, you know, over the course of time, I thought that it was just, you know, once the, you know, the election happened, the people went, cast their electors' ballots and went. But we saw this whole process play out. And in particular, the other day on January 6th, when they certified everything, that was really something that I don't think many people knew. But here I was at 2 o'clock in the morning after what happened, the attacks on the Capitol happened, watching the roll call. Go watching the challenges. It was really something amazing to watch.
Well, kudos to you for watching that. I thought only people like I stay up for that. So kudos to you for doing that and anyone else who did it. But here's the deal. Let's get a little historical perspective.
Yeah.
So normally before this year, that day comes every 4 years, and it basically is a public counting of the ballots in the Congress. The ballots of the electors have already been certified by the states in D.C., and the vice president opens the envelopes and declares the winner. And the last two times it happened, it took, I think, 23 minutes and 41 minutes, the last two elections.
Wow.
It's a pro forma thing. Nobody but the legal people like me are interested in it, and that's fine because it really is very ceremonial. What happened this year is it really is unprecedented, and the reason is because we need so many reforms. The history of all of what happened before the riots and the sedition, but the process goes back to the 12th Amendment in 1804 and the Electoral Count Act of 1887, and I won't bore your audience with all the details, but those are the foundations of that process we were about to watch unfold in a civil way until the terrorists began. And what I think people need to know is that we have a great threat in the next 4 years of this happening another time with another demagogue who's smarter and who has both the House and the Senate in their favor doing irreparable damage to the country. So what we really should be focusing on in this area are reforms that have been talked about for decades but may get people's attention this time.
And again, if you're just tuning in to radio.com, we're talking with New York City voting rights and trial attorney Richard C. Bell. His website is richardcbellesquire.com, and his book is Voting, the Ultimate Act of Resistance. And, you know, one of the things that I think was really amazingly well illustrated was how the United States, it's a complicated process, but we saw how it played out. And one of the key things is people always say, you know, why isn't it just a popular vote? Why do we have to worry about electors? But we saw how each individual state really mattered, how all these challenges to voting and individual elections and how it came down to all these states. And every state played a key part in this. And we saw how you had to challenge things individually because we are, states' rights is such a key part of it. And you've heard that over the years. But we really saw an illustration of how important the sovereignties of states and state rights and state elections really are.
Yes, Mike. And so we go back to the premise that we have an electoral college and the chances of a constitutional amendment to abolish it are probably nil. There's another way around that if you someone that like me who agrees it should be the popular vote, and that's something called the National Popular Vote Interstate Compact, which 16 states and D.C. have already enacted, but it will not go in effect until they have a number of states that would equal 270, and that would be a state legislatures getting around the Electoral College, because what it would mean is that your state agrees that whoever wins the popular vote gets all of their electoral votes, no matter which way your particular state went. But you need enough states to get to 270 for that, and then that would be challenged in the courts, and we'd see where that goes. But short of that changing, right now we do have an Electoral College, so we do need to focus on how best to have a process that is both civil and fair and is not run by demagogues and people doing political posturing and inciting people to break the law, because that's obviously not what any republic wants.
I think that was one of the more troubling things that we saw the other day was that, look, people protest. We see this all the time. And one of the things that really infuriates me is the false equivalencies we've seen over the past few days of people saying, well, oh, look, you know, how is this different than the Black Lives Matter rallies? There was violence there. And it's just like, stop. When you try to create something like that, you're not, it's like a bait and switch. I had a conversation with someone talking about what happened, and they said to me, well, what about what happened in Portland? It's irrelevant. We're talking about what happened the other day. Let's not lose what happened. What we saw was a bunch of people who believed false information. Now, look, false information has never been more able to be spread than it is today. Social media, I mean, this has come up again and again. You know, I work in media, and our company is held to a certain standard. We cannot put out blatantly false information. But social media is not held to that standard, and you see false information spread nonstop. And I don't think there's ever been an easier time to buy into conspiracy theories because of it. Now, what an unprecedented act the other day where social media actually blocked access to social media of the President of the United States. Mind-blowing, right?
Yes, and what you said is a great point, because I will contend that one of the reasons Facebook and Twitter did what they did the other day is that because they know that the Congress and the presidency has changed, and your Senator Elizabeth Warren's coming after them on just this topic of allowing the things they have allowed to do, which turn into seditious behavior.
Yeah.
And they know it, and it was time for them to throw out a little breadcrumb, which Senator Warren's not going to go for, obviously. But the only reason they do this is in their own self-interest, I would contend.
Yeah, well, and that doesn't surprise me. But, you know, it really was an interesting and stunning thing to watch. Now, look, we know that some people aren't happy. And when we talk about people not being happy, look, I'm not saying that anyone has to be happy with the result of the election. You know, it was 80 million and 74 million people. So a huge chunk of people supported Donald Trump. You know, and that's their right. I would never question anyone's right to cast their vote.
Of course not.
For you.
Of course
do your
it's
thing.
Their right to vote. Do your thing, right?
Right. But the amazing thing was what happened the other day was not only did a sitting president encourage a huge crowd to come out to something, and then people stood up and basically said, let's go. Let's stop this process.
Let's go. A sitting senator, Josh Hawley, gave them the power fist.
And we saw the former governor of New York, or the former mayor of New York City, basically saying, let's go and find our president through trial by combat. I mean, it was
absolutely those words. That's correct.
And the idea that, look, I'm not trying to give a pass to the crowd. No one gets a pass on what happened.
No, of course not. No one would ever take that stance.
But to have people in power in that situation, regardless of where you sit on the political spectrum, to have people who are in office encouraging behavior such as this, it has to. Have we seen this previously? I mean, you're a historical, an expert on history. Have we seen things like this happen in the process prior?
Well, you don't have to go back that far to Joe McCarthy. It's not that long ago where he ruined lives and threatened careers of very fine people because he made all kinds of false accusations and got this country on fire for a number of years. So this isn't the first time. George Wallace, I remember growing up watching Judge Wallace and Lester Maddox. Yeah, this has been done before, but it's never been done by the President of the United States on live TV, and it's unmistakable what he was telling them to do.
It was wild. So let's ask this.
No,
now,
it was.
Now, this is the part where we need further civics lessons. So
sure.
Now, in these days after what happened, a lot of people are talking, invoking the 25th Amendment, and people are like, well, what is that all about? Now, that's a complicated situation. And, you know, for all we know, if they were to invoke that, they wouldn't necessarily have to tell the public. I mean, there's a lot of things about this. Talk about what
means. What it means is that the sitting cabinet by a majority would have to inform the vice president that they believe the president should be removed, either because of his mental state or his seditious acts, and the vice president would have to agree, and then the vice president would have to take that, and the two-thirds of the House and two-thirds of the Senate would have to agree for it to happen. And with the time periods that are allowed, we probably would run out of time if we did it tomorrow. Now, not necessarily, but realistically, we probably wouldn't. The chances of getting 2/3 of anything in the present House and Senate are probably nil. So the second alternative to that is what Nancy Pelosi is talking about. If Pence doesn't get back to her shortly, apparently, according to the Washington Post, he hasn't returned her call on this issue. And so if they were to put out articles of impeachment, vote on them, likely have it pass in the House because it's just a majority, then it would go to the Senate for a 2/3 vote. That's highly unlikely, but politically, it makes everybody take a stand in the Senate. And in terms of practicality, is he actually going to be removed? That's unlikely. And I saw today in the Washington Post this afternoon, actually, reported that Speaker Pelosi said she spoke with the General Milley, of the Chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, about the unstable person in the White House having access to nuclear codes. And his own office confirmed that there was a conversation with Pelosi about nuclear codes. It wouldn't say further, which to me says everything we needed to know.
So here's a second question that goes along with this. Even if it is capable of being done, doesn't that create a further diversion and a further rift for those who believe what they believe? Does this create an even more likely situation where the next person, that party could say, well, look, now we really have a reason. They did get rid of this guy, even though he did blah, blah, blah. Do you create even further division by forcing, you know, the public humiliation, despite what happened? Does that function in a way that could blow up in your face?
Okay, so do we live life in fear, or do we live life with our principles? Because if we live in fear of alienating people, yet we're doing something right, then what do we have? Do we really have a righteous republic? Because if whatever percent of those 74 million people, is there a percent that thinks what happened on Wednesday was okay, then it will be very hard to have a rational discussion with them, because it's not okay under any circumstances. So if we do something, whether it's the 25th Amendment or impeachment, and we do it in a civil manner under the laws of our country, then you can live with what the result is, because you did it civilly and peacefully. And what happened the other day was the losing party not accepting defeat for a peaceful transfer of power and essentially inciting an insurrection. That's very different.
Yeah, it is. And again, you know, one of the things I want to stress here is the fact that, you know, the same way that we didn't want people, you know, the people who said, well, the Black Lives Matter people looted and burned. No, they didn't. There was a very small fringe element that caused some problems at the end of peaceful protest. The same thing with this. We're not indicting the entire Republican Party for what happened the other day.
Of course not.
There was a fringe element that showed up in D.C. and were inspired to violence. And they did that of their own accord. And one of the questions I have is, this one really blew my mind, and this makes me very, very uncomfortable. If a crowd of basically not very well-armed people can breach the Capitol, what happens if that was a real insurrection by an organized group heavily fortified with weapons? If those guys got into the House, that told a very bad story about the security at the Capitol, doesn't it?
Yes, and there's no question that President Biden will be appointing the commission, as will the Congress, to investigate this in incredible failure of security in our iconic Capitol. And I saw today that the Washington Post also this afternoon was reporting that Virginia and D.C. and Maryland were calling for National Guard troops, and allegedly the Defense Department turned them down in real time when it mattered. So we'll find out about that. That's right now an allegation. But you are absolutely correct. This is a monumental failure to protect our sacred government. And let's face it, there's a lot of reasonable theories that the people that breached were in there to possibly take congressmen and women and senators hostage. I mean, that would have been viable if they hadn't escaped in time, right?
Right. And what would have happened if the elector votes, which I saw being taken out, what if those were grabbed? Was there anything that, I mean,
okay, so, good question. So, number one, the person that that took them with them is an absolute hero that thought on her feet and got them out of there. They are the originals. The answer is we would have had a process whereby we could have reproduced them, and I don't think that would have been an issue.
But it was a crazy situation, and you know, and that's one of those things where, what are the, and again, this creates a whole second conversation because, you know, we saw the National Guard armed to the teeth during some of the Black Lives Matter movement protests this summer. None of that was illustrated the other day, which asked the question, is there an equal justice? Which I think that, I don't think there's a real honest question. I don't think anyone could honestly say, no, justice is completely equal for everybody.
And Vice President-elect Biden, when he introduced Merrick Garland and his other three nominees, yes, they directly said it, that if these protesters were black or brown, would this have gone down the same way? The answer is no.
It's hard to process this as where we are, but it is, you know, and I mentioned this earlier, someone had said, you know, we're better than this America, but it kind of illustrates over the past decade or so, we're not better than this. This
we're
is kind
not.
Of
you
who
know
we
what?
Are.
Yeah. So, you know, you're obviously a big sports fan like me.
Oh, of course.
And I know this, but this won't be a popular name for New England, but Bill Parcells once said, you are what your record says you are.
We love Bill. He turned around this franchise. So.
He did turn around, but I know, you know, still with the Giants background here. But so Bill said it correct. You are what your record says you are. This is who we are right now. Yeah. Not our whole country, obviously, and hopefully not the majority of our country, I don't think. But this is our country right now. I mean, we need a lot of very honest discussions and a lot of very honest actions to turn this around.
No, we really do. So when we talk about the voter reform that we see, what we can do, what are some of the things that you think are out there? Because, again, you know, you wrote the book, Voting, the Ultimate Act of Resistance. And, again, this is New York City voting rights and trial attorney Richard C. Bell we're talking to. Talk about how we can go further with voter reform, because we've seen great turnout. And we want to see this turnout continue. And we want to make sure that accessibility to voting, so many challenges were put out there, like to mail-in ballots. And the idea that we have to limit the way you can vote, I think is crazy. I think this way was functional. Do you see problems with it?
Okay, so first of all, one of the first acts passed by the House when Nancy Pelosi took over is voting rights reforms and things like, you know, the extension of the mail-in ballots, the same-day registration, automatic registration, a lot of the things that happened because of COVID, even though that bill came before COVID, are things we need to extend. Okay, it's obvious, more voting places, not purging rolls. Those things are all obvious. I don't know if they can obviously be passed, but they're all obvious, and we know they work. But then there's a whole group of things that should happen as a result of what we saw Wednesday that have been around for decades by law professors and voting rights lawyers that nobody thinks about. Maybe they'll start thinking about it. I'll give you a few. I'll rattle them off. So, number one, what you saw in Michigan when you had that ceremonial canvassing board, and they were about to not accept the results of the election. You know, state by state, if you have these ceremonial boards that are basically clerical, get rid of them. You only need state and local administrators who actually determine the vote totals, obviously subject to any court challenges, but you don't need these ceremonial people that all of a sudden one afternoon decide they're going to talk to the president and they're going to try to overturn the results of an election. So that's a simple one the states can do. Another thing the states can do is they can bar their legislators by law that you cannot choose rival slates of electors to go to the Electoral College, that you can say, no, you have to choose one. We have to resolve it, and internal issues will resolve. But it didn't happen this time. It, you know, the last time it happened was in 1876. But you don't want any chance, because you saw what happened. Number of legislators wanted that to happen, where they'd send in their own slate. There should be a rule that says the term failed election in that Electoral Count Act, specifically means a failed election. It was a natural disaster. Nobody could vote, and we couldn't vote for 12 weeks. That's a real failed election. Short of that, it shouldn't be. How about you have a federal law that raises the threshold of objecting to the Electoral College votes, meaning you can't have Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz make unsubstantiated political posturing. You force them under law to have specified, substantiated lists of allegations of fraud before you would even entertain it. So that at least you have some, you know exactly what it's about, and it's not just political rhetoric. I think that's another good one. Another one is that the federal government could make sure that the Electoral Count Voters Act is changed so the time within which states to meet and resolve their problems isn't what this year was December 14th. Maybe you make it January 1st. You give a lot of time for the courts and the legislature to iron out problems so that you know when those votes are cast, it is in stone. And you can also have that act amended from 1887. It's been amended a couple times, but that is the most ambiguous act that most professors and lawyers have ever seen, because you could argue either side of the issue of what is the role of governors, what is the role of the vice president, what if you take away one slate and now you're below 538 and nobody can get to 270. Does that mean a plurality? Does that mean you have to put in another slate? These are unanswered questions. You can't have these as unanswered questions anymore.
Right, right.
And then just a couple quick things for lawyers, because the lawyers for the Trump campaign, in my opinion, they defiled my profession. Because you should have laws both at the state and federal level that say if you're contesting an election, in your complaint that you're filing with the court, it has to specifically state whether there is an allegation of fraud, and if so, there should be a standard of specificity where you have to list exactly what your allegations are, and if a judge doesn't find fraud, the court should be required to state that, so when it goes on appeal, it's not ambiguous what the judge said. And then you should have an ethics rule for state bar associations. As a lawyer, I'm an officer of the court. When I say something to the court takes it as true. And if it's not true, I can lose my license. So you should have an ethics rule that says if you allege voter fraud on the steps of the courthouse, and incite people and then go inside the courthouse like Rudy Giuliani and admit to the judge in Pennsylvania, no, there's no allegations of fraud, that's an ethics violation that should be have a severe penalty to it. And then, of course, the House and the Senate should have their own internal rules. If you're a candidate and you won your House race and then you proclaimed that the election was a fraud and it was rigged, but for the president but not for me, I think that's something that should be investigated.
No, they're all great points. Well, look, it's always a great conversation with you, Attorney Bell. Again, New York City voting rights and trial attorney Richard C. Bell. The book, Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. If you hadn't been inspired to read a book about voting, I think that we've seen just how important it is. This is an important book. Also, the website, Richard C. Bell, ESQ.com. It is always a great conversation. I appreciate your time.
No, my honor, Mike. I really enjoy these because you ask the tough questions and I'm not afraid to give you the tough answers.
Always appreciate it. Thank you, sir.
My pleasure. Thank you.